bioethics and worldview, how fundamental assumptions will shape the future. And what I'd like to do tonight, by way of structuring and providing a kind of framework for the whole series, is I'd like to just introduce you, and here I'm not assuming any level of familiarity, to what bioethics is. What is this word, bioethics? What are we talking about when we're talking about bioethics? What are the kinds of topics that we're going to be dealing with over the next several weeks that our speakers will be talking about? And then I want to spend a little bit of time talking about worldview as a concept. What does that mean, and how does it relate to the topic of bioethics? And then the meat of my talk tonight, the real sort of the heart of it, will be to identify two prevailing worldviews that I think in our culture are potentially going to have some really serious consequences for the direction that bioethics might go. And I think that these two prevailing cultural worldviews, you'll be able to see once I've identified them, how they might eventually work themselves out in these bioethical issues. Then after I've identified those issues, what I hope to do at that point is to offer what I call a Christian critique of these two worldviews from the perspective of a Christian worldview. Because for those of you who aren't here for course credit, Union University is a Christian institution. We make no apology for that. I am a Christian as well, and part of the purpose of this series is not only to engage important intellectual issues of our day, but to engage them specifically from a Christian perspective. And this, in particular, is near and dear to my heart because I think some of the challenges in bioethics really need deeply to have Christians engage them from a thinking and thoughtful perspective, from a Christian worldview. So that's what I hope to do tonight. So with that in mind, when we talk about bioethics, what is it that we're talking about? What is it that we're interested in? Well, I thought what I'd do is I'd actually begin by giving you some examples. And these are just very recent examples and just a sampling of some of the issues that we're dealing with when we're talking about bioethics. So a recent news story in the Wall Street Journal was actually entitled Ovatime. Ovatime. Women line up to donate eggs for money. Women line up to donate eggs for money. How many of you have even heard that this is happening? Okay, a few of you have, right? Some of you haven't. So this is actually something that is now occurring, and the reason that this story found its way into the Wall Street Journal is because actually since the recent economic downturn, more and more women are finding that this is a lucrative way of earning some extra cash. So they've actually seen a rise in the number of women who are willing to donate their eggs for other people's pregnancies and other people's babies. So you have this quotation from the article which says, some clinics are reporting a surge in the number of women applying to donate eggs or to serve as surrogate mothers for couples. The going rate for a surrogate, that is someone who carries someone else's baby, a few years ago, Newsweek had a cover story, the title of which was Womb for Rent. Surrogate mothers, the going rate is about $25,000. Egg donors, that's someone who simply donates their eggs for someone else's pregnancy, is about $3,000 to $8,000. But then note what the article says. But a few agencies advertise that they'll pay much more for specific characteristics. One ad running in campus newspapers promises $25,000. That's just for an egg donor. For a donor who is 100% Jewish, with high SAT scores, attractive, at healthy body weight, and free of genetic diseases. Now, I realize that some of this may be so shocking that there's almost a kind of laughter that we feel in shock, right? Having never seen anything like this before, perhaps. But at the same time, part of what we want to wrestle with over this series is whether or not these kinds of practices are a good idea. And while these things may not be close to our own personal lives, these are huge cultural issues with potentially some very significant cultural consequences. And these things are being debated right now among many scientists, many doctors, and many bioethicists as well. Here's another example. This is a little bit more Frankenstein-esque. A recent story from the BBC News, actually the BBC has been tracking this developing story since April, and the reference that I have here is from April, but there's been a series of follow-ups because there's been an ongoing legal battle that's related to this particular issue. In the UK, in Great Britain, there's been much debate over a new bill that actually recently passed in the Parliament there. The bill was a bill that fell under what was called the Human Embryology and Fertilization Act. I believe that was its title. And the bill included a great deal of regulations, some having to do with the practice of in vitro fertilization, some having to do with stem cell research, and different kinds of restrictions and regulations on that. And the story, actually, this is just the story that I quoted from here, is a story in which, from the article, scientists at Newcastle have created part human, part animal hybrid embryos. Sometimes in the literature, these sorts of creatures are actually referred to as chimeras. Chimeras, and that just comes from an ancient Greek mythological monster. So there actually is a word that they're almost calling them monstrous, sometimes called chimera research. So these embryos, and this is actually a picture of them here from the article itself, what you're looking at in a petri dish look like ordinary cells, but actually the article says they are hybrids. They are part human, part animal. They were created using a technique in which the scientists will take a skin cell, say, from an adult human being. They'll remove the DNA from the nucleus of that cell, and then they'll take an egg from a cow, and they'll take the nuclear material out of that cow's egg and put in the human DNA, and then begin to grow and develop this in a petri dish. Now, some of you might be scratching your heads and thinking, why in the world would they want to do this in the first place? Well, part of it is related just to simply straightforward scientific research in the development of early embryology and how those cells develop. But also what this is connected to ultimately is it's connected to stem cell research, which you've perhaps heard a lot about in the news. And since there is a great deal of difficulty in getting human beings, women in particular, to donate eggs for this kind of research, they have available supply by using all the cows in the UK for this kind of research, and so it's a lot simpler for them to do this. Now, whether or not they would ever allow such an organism to actually develop till full term, that's another huge question. At this point, most of the people who are involved in this sort of research are opposed to that. But of course, one of the serious dangers is whether or not that opposition would ever stay in place over the long term. So this is another example from the news of something we're talking about when we're talking about bioethics. That one's a little bit more like Frankenstein. This one is a little bit more practical. This is real life stuff. This comes from a very recent article, December 11th, just this past month, in the scientific journal Nature. And in that journal, a group of scientists, a group of prominent scientists, about seven of them, got together and they wrote a commentary piece. It was an editorial. And in that editorial, they set out to challenge one of the basic assumptions right now that really governs medical practice and also pharmaceutical practice. And that basic assumption is that medicine is really primarily for healing and not for enhancement. Right? So medicine, the assumption in medicine is that medicine is for primarily for healing purposes or restorative purposes, as opposed to having just simply enhancing purposes. So, of course, one of the major medicines that's out there in use, especially among young people today, are medicines that help attention disorders, right? ADD and ADHD, many of you either may know kids or perhaps have kids or grandkids who are on medications like Adderall or like Ritalin or other kinds of cognitive enhancers. And in the most severe cases, these medicines serve very important purposes because they take children or young people who otherwise have no ability to focus. They have no ability to focus intensely on what they're doing because of some really deep psychological or cognitive problems that they're struggling with. And these particular medicines actually enable them to do that. They increase their attention, their focus, their ability to execute cognitive functions. And so that's what these medicines do for them. And what really governs or regulates as a kind of principle the distribution of these medicines now widely in the culture is the idea that what these medicines are for is they are for people who need them because they are actually suffering from a condition in which it helps them, right? But of course now there's a problem, and you all may know about the problem. The problem is that many college students, and we got a few young college students in here, and so if you didn't know about this, college students, shame on you for now finding it out. Don't go doing anything bad. Many college students are discovering that you can actually use these medicines, even if you're a perfectly healthy college student, to enhance their own cognitive abilities. So in a lot of universities and colleges, an increasing percentage of students are acquiring these medications on the black market, and then they're taking them during intense times where they need a boost, right? During final exam week, perhaps when they've got to write that major paper right before it's due, because these drugs serve as cognitive stimulants. They actually enhance their ability to think more clearly, to focus more attentively. And currently, right now, this is illegal. And so if you're a college student and you're engaged in this and you're caught, you can get into some serious trouble. Okay, now enter this particular commentary written by these seven prominent scientists who say, you know what, the time has come for us to change our underlying thinking about medicine and what it's for. And instead of just using these drugs for healing purposes or for helping those who are sick, we actually now need to use these drugs for enhancement purposes. We need to take healthy people, you know, perfectly healthy people, and give them the opportunity to use these kinds of drugs as a way of enhancing their own cognitive functions. And they're advocating this. They're saying this is the way to go. Now, of course, they would argue, as they do in this particular essay, that what needs to happen is that it needs to be regulated, we need to make sure there are safeguards in place so that there's no abuse. But at the same time, they say, this is the direction that we need to head. This is where we need to go. So this is what we're talking about when we're talking about bioethics. We're talking about a whole series of issues like these that are in the news almost daily. And some of the problems that arise begin to get so complex, they really are hard to untangle. Part of the purpose of the series is to introduce you not only to the issues, but also to give you an opportunity to hear from some speakers who will do an outstanding job of untangling some of these issues for us. So bioethics, what is it in a nutshell? The term simply has to do with the ethics of life. The term bios or bio comes from the Greek term that pertains to life. And of course, ethics is the study of morality, having to do with what's good or bad, or what we ought to do, what's right or wrong. Now, this definition is really just a matter of the etymology of the term itself. And what I want to do now is I want to give you a set of categories that might help you to frame some of the issues that we're going to be talking about over the next several weeks. And I have to tell you that the categories are not my own. The categories actually come from a prominent bioethicist. His name is Nigel Cameron. Nigel Cameron came up with a set of three categories. I think these are really helpful, so I just commend him for thinking in this way. And those categories are really represented on the next several slides. Most of you, I think, should have a handout. And over the next several slides, you'll see that there are three major categories. Taking life, making life, and remaking life. Okay? Taking life, making life, and then remaking life. And then under the heading of remaking life, I've actually done some of my own division into a few more categories, which will be helpful. But those three major categories, taking life, making life, and remaking life, will give you kind of a framework in which you can organize all of these complex issues as they crop up. So very briefly, just introducing you to these categories, what are some of the common issues that show up in each of these three categories? Well, under the category of making life, when we're talking in bioethics, we're talking about such issues as abortion, and related to this, issues having to do with contraception. I skipped between two categories, didn't I? I'll try that again. We're talking about assisted reproduction. Now, assisted reproduction is really a broad conceptual term that actually covers a range of procedures that are designed at their best to treat infertility. I've actually just given you two examples of assisted reproduction. One of the most familiar and probably most talked about in the media is the method of in vitro fertilization. And then the other one is what is sometimes referred to as intrauterine insemination, or IUI. There are other methods that are involved in assisted reproduction. I just gave you two examples under this heading. Just very briefly, because it's such an important issue, in vitro fertilization occurs when you have a donation of an egg from a female, and then you have the donation of sperm from the male, and then the egg is actually fertilized in the laboratory. The term in vitro just means in glass, so it's actually, that's what it comes from. It's literally, it's fertilized sort of under a microscope in a glass dish. And what happens after fertilization is that the organism that is a human organism at that point begins to develop for a period of several days, and then at some point in that process, when the couple is ready, that embryo, that human embryo, is implanted into the woman and then allowed to gestate for the ordinary 9-month pregnancy. Now, of course, there's a lot of technical details that are important that have to do with some other issues that are related under this heading that happen as a part of that process. First thing you should know just as part of that process is that typically, when in vitro fertilization is done, it's not typically done with one egg at a time. It's actually typically done with multiple eggs at a time. So in a single treatment of in vitro fertilization, you have a number of eggs that are harvested, and then a number of eggs that are actually fertilized. And so you have the creation of 10 to 12, and perhaps even more, embryos at one time. And once they reach about a 4 or 5 day development point, they are frozen at that point, and they're in sort of a position biologically of stasis, until the time that the couple who is going through this treatment is ready to go through the process of having the embryo implanted and then ultimately carrying it to term. And why is it important to know all this background information? Well, because you may hear a lot in the news about stem cell research, and you may hear about its connection to those frozen embryos, or sometimes they're called leftovers, sometimes they're called discarded embryos, or embryos that are destined to be discarded or destined for destruction, leftover embryos from in vitro fertilization. And why that occurs is because what happens quite frequently for couples who go through in vitro fertilization is that they have one or two children from the embryos that were originally cultivated, and then they decide, well, we're done. But they've actually got 8 to 10, perhaps even more, embryos of their own making, with the help of the scientists, still frozen in stasis. And the question becomes, what to do with them? There's a whole lot of discussion, and it's a huge bioethical issue right now, culturally, what to do. There's not exact numbers, but some people estimate that the number of embryos in fertility clinics in the United States alone that are frozen right now in stasis, and that there's some question about what to do with them, could reach upwards of 400,000. So you've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 400,000 embryos that are frozen And parents who really have legal rights to those don't know exactly what to do with them. The New York Times actually recently had an article on this that was discussing the psychology of many parents who are now struggling to know what to do with that. Some of them, some of the options include donating them to scientific research for research in stem cells. Others simply to allow them to be discarded. There are now some fertility clinics for psychological reasons that are now offering funeral services for the embryos to allow them to thaw and then die, which is just a really interesting phenomenon. And then, of course, what I've got up here on the slide is also now taking place, what are called snowflake adoptions. For those who are willing to allow their embryos to be adopted, there are some parents out there who are now adopting frozen embryos, having those frozen embryos be implanted, and then they develop to term, and they become those folks' children. I actually have an old high school friend who has now done this. She has done this twice, she and her husband. They have adopted I think they've adopted 10 frozen embryos, and she has now carried two of them to term. She has two children. So it's a really fascinating phenomenon. Of course, you have the issue that I mentioned earlier of surrogacy, which is an issue that falls under this category of making life. And of course, as we talked about from that article earlier, you have egg and sperm donation, as well as embryonic stem cell research. Under that second major heading, the heading of taking life, you have the most common issue, which is really one that probably almost all of you are familiar with because it's been in the news so much in the last 35 to 40 years, is the issue of abortion. Perhaps not quite commonly as discussed, but almost equally well known, is the issue of euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide. And connected with this, now increasingly, are what are called advanced directives, or sometimes they're, I think, more badly called living wills. This is where when you begin to approach an age where you are thinking about the prospect of death, not a good topic on a Tuesday night to think about, but a real topic, a real human topic, you begin to contemplate the possibility of sitting down with your doctors and perhaps an attorney and literally laying out in a legal document certain kinds of treatments that should or should not be given to you under various sorts of conditions. And these documents raise a whole range of questions, not the least of which is their legal status. And the other practical reality is whether or not they can be effectively communicated to attending physicians and nurses who might be in hospitals and find themselves treating you or someone with an advanced directive. And then there's the larger questions, the philosophical one, which I hope that we think about over this series, and that is really whether advanced directives are the sorts of things that we ought to be thinking about and doing as human beings when we think about what a human life is supposed to be and what it means to live a human life. We can talk more about that. Then, of course, connected to end-of-life issues is a real serious one, and that's the issue of palliative care. Care for someone who is at the end of life, perhaps suffering from a terminal disease, one that may even be causing a great deal of pain, and just how to go about that. One of the most famous recent cases that really falls under the issue of taking life was the case of Terry Schiavo in the state of Florida. Many of you may remember that case. Got national media attention. And, of course, part of the reason that it got national media attention is because there were questions, scientific questions, about whether Terry Schiavo was, in fact, at the end of her life and whether she was, in fact, suffering from a terminal disease. And there were questions about her care and what sort of care she was entitled to given the condition that she was in. And so under this heading of taking life, you often find discussions of such things as ordinary care versus extraordinary care. You may hear things discussed about vegetative states. You may hear discussions about brain death versus heart death. Whole range of issues that fall in this category. Beyond this, I mentioned earlier that the third category that Nigel Cameron gives us is this category that is called remaking life. And many of you may have familiarity to some degree or another with the issues that fall in the first two categories, the categories of taking life and of making life. But the issues that I think are going to be some of the most challenging issues of the 21st century really fall in this third category. And many of them are not getting a lot of media attention. And that's partly because they are so cutting edge, and most of them are taking place at really high levels of theoretical science. But under the heading of remaking life, you really have, I think, three broad areas, and I put these on the series of the next three slides. One area in which there's issues that come up related to remaking life is the area of genetics. Another is the area of pharmaceuticals and the use of drugs in remaking life. And then third is the use of technology in remaking life. And I want to just briefly kind of give you, again, some introductory remarks about the things that are happening in each of these three areas. First of all, one of the most common, and perhaps at this point some of our greatest technological capacities, have to do with prenatal screening. Prenatal screening can occur in really one of two ways. A common way in which it occurs, when it occurs, is in utero, that is to say when there's already an embryo or a fetus that's developing in the midst of a pregnancy. There are various tests that doctors can now do and have done for a number of years, often using amniocentesis as a procedure, to really test for the presence of certain genetic diseases. Testing for genetic diseases in utero is really in some ways sort of old school prenatal testing. New school prenatal testing is usually connected to in vitro fertilization. Because what happens in this case is that couples who are going through in vitro fertilization have the option of testing all of the 10 to 12 or perhaps more embryos that they have produced in the laboratory for various genetic markers, and then choosing which one they want to implant in the hopes of carrying that child to term. Many of you can probably, I see your wheels turning, you probably already see where this could be headed, right? Parents, for example, might have the option, if they want to have a boy, to make sure before they implant that it's a boy. Or if they want to have a girl, they can do the same. As the technology increases and as our scientific ability to test for various genetic markers increases, some believe that we'll now also continue to have options of saying testing for blue eyes. Right? We want to make sure we have a blue-eyed child. We want to make sure we have a child who has blonde hair, perhaps. I don't know. All kinds of various genetic markers, as we continue to develop the technology to identify them, become candidates for this kind of a procedure. And depending upon how that sort of practice gets regulated, the future could really look vastly different than it looks right now if we don't think carefully about that and some of the consequences. Then the other issue is the issue of stem cell research, which has been much discussed and is in the news because many scientists believe that stem cells can be used to cultivate healthy colonies of various kinds of differentiated cells to give to people who have different kinds of disease. The controversy, of course, in stem cell research is not whether we ought to do it at all, but the controversy really concerns the sources from which we obtain stem cells. Most controversial being obtaining stem cells from human embryos, and in particular those human embryos that have been left over from in vitro fertilization. Less controversial is obtaining them from adult donors who perhaps donate them from various places in their bodies where stem cells can be acquired. And I'm not going to go into all the details about where you can get stem cells in your body unless we want to talk about that during Q&A. And then, of course, you have the issue of genetic manipulation itself. As our understanding of the human genome increases, and as our ability to manipulate the genome increases, you have possibilities for both healing and also for enhancement in various kinds of ways. And so one of the most significant questions as we think about what we're calling remaking life is whether or not we want to use our genetic knowledge and our ability to manipulate the human genome just for purposes of curing disease, or whether we want to actually use that knowledge and that skill to do what we might call making a better human being. And for those of you who are students of history, and I suspect we have a few in here tonight who are students of history, that might give you pause when you start thinking about the possibility of making or creating a better human being, or perhaps even a better race of human beings, right? And yet, as we have this kind of knowledge, that's going to be one of the questions that we're faced with. How do we use it? The consequences for the use of genetic manipulation is often differentiated between what's called somatic versus germline genetic therapy or genetic engineering. This really has to do with the place where you do the manipulation. If you just simply limit it to one person, or is it going to have implications for future generations? And the difference is really this. If you do genetic manipulation of the somatic sort, the consequences for that genetic manipulation is really limited to just one person. It's just limited to the person whom you give the genetic treatment to. But if you actually do the genetic manipulation at what's called the germline, and that involves manipulating the genes that are in the eggs and the sperm, literally, then you pass on those genetic markers as a matter of inheritance to future generations of human beings. And so that the possibility that that might occur is something that really it deserves serious consideration. And what you'll find out there among many scientists and philosophers and theologians and pundits and politicians is you'll find that there's a whole wide range of opinions on whether or not this is a good idea. I think our speaker actually next week, Joy Riley, will be touching on this theme of genetic manipulation and the impact that it may or may not have on future generations. So it's going to be, I think, a really interesting talk. Secondly, under the heading of remaking life, you have this question about the ability to remake life or to treat our current lives by the use of drugs. One really mundane example, although it may not be mundane if you're a baseball fan, is the use of steroids, right? Performance-enhancing drugs. We now have just a marvelous array of medicines at our disposal. Many of which were just unfathomable, perhaps in your parents' or grandparents' lifetime. And they can do amazing things to the human body. But they can do things which are beyond simply helping us feel better. They can now make us, in words of one bioethicist, smarter, faster, and stronger, right? Smarter, faster, and stronger. This is why this issue really falls under remaking life. We now have the capacities increasingly, daily and monthly and year by year, to introduce drugs which, given their properties, have at least the promise of making us healthy, perhaps helping us to live longer, perhaps making us stronger, as in the case of performance-enhancing drugs, and perhaps making us smarter, as in the case of some of these cognitive enhancers. And questions arise about whether or not this is something that we ought to do. As I've already mentioned from the article from the journal Nature, you have at least a handful of scientists who are out there who are saying, this is exactly what we need to be doing. We need to be heading in a direction where we are using all of the resources at our disposal, including the resources that come from the pharmaceutical industry, to make life, or to remake life, to make it better. That's why it's under the heading of remaking life. And of course, remaking life or making life better for those scientists involves allowing the regulated use of various drugs to enhance our abilities to think. And I think part of the reason I bring this up as such a serious issue is because in our lifetimes, daily, if not year after year, the options that will be at our disposal for doing this are just going to increase exponentially. And part of the question that this whole series is about is whether or not we should, whether that's a good idea. Will it really make us happy? Will it really make us more human or perhaps less human if we do this? And of course, on a very real level, that's what baseball fans everywhere wrestle with when they discover favorite athletes who are caught using performance-enhancing drug. Does this really make the game better? Does it really make it a more interesting game? Is it really what it's all about? And that's really the question that this whole series is about. Really exciting, again, filled with possibilities and promise, but also potential perils, is the area of what's now called pharmacogenetics. It's also sometimes called pharmacogenomics. One of the things that's exciting about this area of research is that it's sort of the intersection of genetic research and research in drugs in a way that could potentially provide drugs that are specifically suited to your genetic profile. Now, right now, the technology does not exist and our knowledge doesn't exist to tailor-make drugs to every individual person's genetic profile. But one of the things that's happening right now in terms of current research and has a great deal of promise, it's taking place not too far from here, just down the road, my hometown of Memphis, at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. There are many scientists who are doing research with drugs and their interaction with specific families of genetic profiles. And what they're able to do is they've discovered that people with certain kinds of genetic profiles react differently to certain kinds of chemotherapy treatments. And so, of course, chemotherapy, if you've had friends or loved ones who've gone through such treatments, or perhaps you have even yourself, you know that chemotherapy is often attended with some very serious side effects because of the toxicity of the drugs. Well, now what they're able to do, thanks to this kind of research, is they're actually able to reduce the dosages based upon someone's genetic profile to not only kill the cancer, but simultaneously to reduce the toxicity, to reduce the side effects. And that's thanks to this kind of intersection between pharmaceutical research and genetic research. Of course, one of the perils of this sort of research as it progresses and as it goes forward is this. Will the pharmaceutical industry really support this kind of research since it potentially could reduce their profit margin, right? Right now, they're able to make a single drug and it's able to be sort of used widely in a wide variety of cases, whereas this could get expensive if they start having to make drugs for specific narrow populations of people or even down to specific people. And that, of course, will increase the cost of the drugs, and then we have a complicated issue related to insurance, health insurance, whether or not insurers will support that kind of drug for their clients. And that even raises another question that I haven't even put up here at all, and that is this, issues related to genetic privacy and health insurance. Right? That's also tied up in all this discussion. So there's a wide range of issues that are connected here to this exciting area. Third, and under this category of remaking life, this is probably my favorite. I don't know why it's my favorite, except that it really just fires my imagination. Maybe it's because I have a slight interest in science fiction. Not a deep interest in science fiction, but an ever so slight interest in science fiction. And this area of remaking life is sort of the stuff of science fiction. It really is. Because one of the ways in which we now have the capacity to, quote, remake life increasingly every day is in the interface between various kinds of machines, really sophisticated machines, and biological bodies, our biological bodies, human beings. And of course, like all the other categories that we've talked about tonight and all the other issues we've touched on tonight, there are great promises in this sort of research, but there are also potential costs, potential concerns in this, in each of these areas. So, of course, one of the great promises is the ability to produce artificial limbs and perhaps even certain kinds of machines which replace bodily organs, and do so in a way which give life and perhaps even give enhanced life to people who otherwise would not have it. The picture actually up here is a picture of a more sophisticated artificial limb. I think possibly our speaker on the third night of this series will be actually touching on this subject. But the ability that we have now to produce artificial limbs is just mind-boggling, because now we can actually connect them directly to the nervous system in some rather sophisticated ways that allows them to be manipulated by brain signals in exactly the way that you manipulate your arms and legs now. It's just really incredible. So they look a lot more like this. And of course, you also have research that's ongoing with brain implants. That is to say, when they literally take computer chips they're actually connected to neurons and portions of the brain. And what that enables some people to do, who are perhaps paraplegic, is actually enables them to communicate directly using their brains. They've done research, this is actually somewhat old at this point, with some very severe cases where, and I forget the term off the top of my head, so I apologize, but there are very rare cases in which human beings have a physical condition which renders them not comatose, but completely unable to communicate. And so there's still a lot of higher order brain activity going on, but they almost completely lack the ability to communicate. And what this brain implant has actually enabled them to do is enabled them to use their frontal cortex to manipulate a mouse cursor on a screen through an electrode that is directly connected to the brain, and that enables them to communicate even though they can't otherwise. And then, of course, there's discussion. Most of this is still speculative and theoretical at this point about the possibility of using computers to enhance memory in the same way that you enhance memory in your own computer, your computer at work, by getting a chip, right? A memory chip that will actually enhance your memory. Then you have some that are a little bit more science fiction. You have the area of wearable computing. This is a little bit less drastic in terms of its sci-fi nature, although it's more common nowadays, increasingly. You have people who are experimenting with various kinds of computers that you can wear. You can wear them in the form of glasses, and these things can give you all kinds of information. Potentially, there are some who are sort of future theorists who theorize that you could actually have a device which would enable you to be walking down the street and to identify a person, because the computer that you have that you're wearing would actually read who that person is and then provide you right on your screen, on your glasses, with all the information about who that is. Name, birthday, who they're related to, and so forth, right? And the technology for this really isn't too far away. You think about now already, got the capacity to do that with GPS and your iPhone, right? It's only a small step to do that by having everybody get implants that contain that kind of information, or perhaps carry a card with that kind of information. And then you have computer technology that when you're within a certain number of feet of a person, it brings that up for you and you have it right there. So there's all kinds of interesting possibilities there. And then somewhat connected to that issue is this last one, the phrase transhumanism. Transhumanism. You now have a group of scientists and thinkers, computer scientists, who identify themselves as transhumanists. And the transhumanists are actually advocating what they're thinking of as the next phase of human evolution. It's the next phase of human evolution. We've evolved to a certain point throughout our history, so they say, and then we're now at the point where we're ready to go through the next phase of human evolution, where what will happen is there will be sort of this one giant consciousness that we'll all share in common that will involve the interface between human beings and computers. There's already a name for it. It's called Google. So that transhumanists may not be too far off. And so the idea of transhumanism is the idea that we are meant to, and we ought to, transcend our humanity. And the way we're going to transcend our humanity is through the use of technology. Last but not least, one of the issues in this area is an issue called nanotechnology. Nanotechnological research is really an interesting area of research that has to do with the use of, to put it really sort of cartoonishly, really, really tiny robots that could be used actually in various medical treatments. I actually recently talked with a graduate student at the University of Memphis who was doing this sort of research. He was actually doing research in nanotechnology, and he was describing to me some of the details of the research, which please don't ask me to recount. I couldn't possibly do that. But it does have the promise of using small machines, basically, effectively, to treat medical conditions in the body, perhaps even cancer treatments or other treatments, because of the capacity of these machines to be put into your bloodstream and for them, through the use of various chemicals, to actually go to specific sites within the body and then do certain kinds of work that they need to do there. Again, it sounds very sci-fi, but this is the kind of research that's going on in this area, and it really has the potential for changing the way that we think about life. Now, what I want to do in the time that I have left is to talk about how this is all related. So that's really just an introduction to bioethics. It's quick. It's really 30,000-foot view. And my purpose in introducing you to all those issues is really just to get you acquainted with the landscape, the lay of the land, not so much to say whether any of these things are good or bad. As I've already mentioned, I think there's a lot of promise in each of these areas, but there are also potential challenges, potential concerns in each of these areas. And I wanted you just to be familiar when we're talking about bioethics, what are we talking about? We're talking about all those issues that I've already mentioned and more in these three big categories: making life, taking life, and remaking life. The rest of the time, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about worldview, what worldview is, and then talk some about the prevailing worldviews that are really influencing the current direction of where these issues are headed in our culture. When I refer to our culture, I'm referring primarily to the West in the 21st century, Western Europe, Great Britain, the United States, and Canada, those developed nations. We might add to that a little bit other industrialized nations which are doing cutting-edge biotechnological research, places like China and other places. But there are some different issues that some of the poorer third world countries are dealing with that's related to these kinds of issues. I won't go into those right now. So how is it that worldview is connected to the issue of bioethics? Well, here's the answer in a nutshell. How you as individuals and how we as a society or other societies respond to the bioethical challenges that we face is a direct function of worldview. In other words, how we act, how we what we do when we sit in front of our doctor and our doctor lays out a variety of different options for us to choose from, how you respond to your doctor in terms of what you're going to do is going to be an outgrowth of your worldview. How you vote when you go to the polls and you vote for a particular candidate, that's going to be an outgrowth of your worldview. How these thinkers and scientists and political pundits think about the shape and the direction and the future of all these issues is in direct growth of their worldview. Now, what do I mean when I talk about worldview? Well, that could be a whole semester's course on its own, but I think it's really something that I can summarize very quickly just like this. At the heart of a worldview is an implicit or even sometimes explicit assumption about two things. First, about what life is all about. And then second, about the proper limits, if there are any, to succeeding in fulfilling what life is all about. Right? So you've got purpose, or end, and you've got means. Right? Ends and means. The worldview is about what life is all about and how you get there, and whether or not there are any limits on what you're allowed to do in getting there. That's at the heart of a person's worldview. And what I'm suggesting tonight is that how you and I and how our culture will respond to all of these different issues is going to be a direct function of the implicit or explicit assumptions that we make about what life's purpose is and about whether or not there are any limits on achieving life's purpose. So in our culture today, this is really my analysis. This is sort of me going like this, checking the winds. Those of you who play golf, right? I'm sort of checking the cultural winds, and I'm suggesting tonight that there are really, in our culture, again, this is the 21st century Western culture, there are two major prevailing worldviews that are out there that are shaping the course and the direction of where we're headed with all these different bioethical issues. I've given them names, and although the names, of, well, at least the first name, the first worldview, sounds pejorative, although it sounds pejorative, sounds like I mean it meanly, I actually don't. I mean it simply descriptively. I mean to just describe what that worldview is. I'm not trying to, at this point, say anything negative about it with the name, although I'm going to say some negative things about it in just a moment, but I don't mean to with just the name. So the first worldview I suggest that's in our culture that's prevalent is what I'm calling hedonistic consumerism, okay? Hedonistic consumerism. Now, of course, it may sound like it's a bad thing because normally when people call you a hedonist or you accuse you of hedonism, they're accusing you of something bad. But on the face of it, to be called a hedonist is really just to be called someone who believes that in the final analysis or in the grand scheme of things, life is just fundamentally about pleasure. I mean, that's what you think the purpose of life is. That's what life is about. And if you're a hedonist, you really fall in that category. Whether that's a good or a bad thing is sort of immaterial at this point. If that's your worldview, if that's your outlook, then that's what you really think life is about. When you get down to it, it's about the one who has the most toys at the end, right? And who's had the most fun, and who's sort of gone around the wheel and just enjoyed it the most. And you can either be a hedonist who really focuses exclusively on yourself, or you can be sort of a more egalitarian hedonist, right? You can think that your hedonism should sort of spread around to a lot of other people. But in the end, you think that that's what it's about. Now, the consumerism part is really about the limits, the proper limits of how you get there, how you get the most pleasure out of life. And what a hedonistic consumerist says is it says this, something like this, that the only limits on your pursuit of pleasure are market forces or perhaps democratic forces, right? It's either majority vote, it's what the most people tell you. So if you've got a bunch of people who say you can't do that, and we've all voted and told you you can't do that, then that's a limit on your pursuit of pleasure. That's a democratic force. Or you've got some hedonistic consumerists who say, look, the only restrictions are really going to be built into a kind of economic market, right? The marketplace will really determine this. And it will turn out in the end that what the market's job is to do is to maximize our opportunities for the pursuit of pleasure because that's what life is all about. I'm suggesting that that's one of the major worldviews today that's sort of out there and that is implicitly or explicitly believed by a lot of people. And that's one of the possibilities for shaping the direction of our future in these bioethical issues. Second worldview, second possibility, is what I call technological humanistic altruism. Technological humanistic altruism. And this one perhaps sounds a little bit more kind. And I put it up there because, not just because I want to be kind, although I do, but I put it up there because I really do think there are a lot of good-minded, good-hearted people out there with good intentions. And they really sincerely do have good intentions for humanity in these sorts of issues. And what they think life is about is they think life is principally about advancing human interests and well-being. And that doesn't always mean pleasure for them, right? They have a conception of the good. They have a conception of human well-being or of living a good life. And they want that available to as many people as possible, and so they have a certain kind of altruism to their view. They're not just interested in themselves, they're not just pleasure seekers, they're not just driven by their strongest desire, they're actually driven by a kind of noble vision. They have a noble vision for humanity, and they want to see that come to pass. And the interesting thing, I think, about this worldview is that the only major restrictions on how to get there are really going to be the restrictions that come from sort of the top down, so to speak. I mean, really the difference between these two is that this is sort of bottom up, and this is top down. So in the technological humanistic altruism, what they maintain is they say that researchers, scientific researchers, and those who are in technology, perhaps in cooperation with some government authority, those are the people, they're the experts, so to speak. The experts are the ones who are best situated to tell all of us what's in our own best interest, right? And so the limits on what we ought to do with technology or what we ought to do with genetic manipulation, those limits are going to be determined by experts. Whereas in this view, the limits, if any, are determined by market forces or by democratic vote. Okay? And you know, one great example, I think, of technological humanistic altruism comes straight out of that article that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk from Nature, where you've got a group of seven scientists who are writing an op-ed piece for a very prominent scientific journal, and they're basically telling the country, here's what we think is good for you, right? Here's what we think is good for you. And to the extent that lobbyists and politicians and other powerful pundits are influenced by their perspective, what you could end up with is you could end up with a situation in which you have the experts effectively setting the boundaries on what is in the best interest of human beings. They're saying, we think it's in the best interest of human beings. And I don't think that we should view them as actually wicked people, right? Because I think they really think of themselves, and I think perhaps rightly so, as having human interest in mind. They're not themselves just pleasure seekers. After all, if they were, they wouldn't be doing the kind of high-level science that they're doing, right? They have devoted themselves to a noble cause. They have a noble vision of human well-being. And yet, this is their worldview. Right? Their worldview is a kind of humanistic altruism that's connected to the advance of science and technology. So these are the two worldviews that I think are out there. I think they're the most prevalent in our culture. And for the remainder of the time that I have left, which I hope to wrap up in about the next 15 minutes or so, to give you a chance to interact and ask some questions before we break, is I want to say something about this worldview from a Christian perspective. I want to offer a Christian critique. Not just because I think the Christian critique is important, but because part of the purpose of this entire series is for us to think about how a Christian perspective might come to bear on some of the issues that we've talked about. So, very quickly, a Christian worldview is really going to be one that's based in what I call the biblical meta-narrative. Don't get thrown by the word meta-narrative. I actually think it's an ugly word myself. But it's a word that's part of the lingua franca among academics, and so I use it tonight because it's there. The word meta-narrative just means big story. So if you want to write in your notes, big story, that's what it means. It's an overarching story. It's a sort of the story of everything. And the idea here is that from a Christian perspective, there is a story of everything. There's a story of how the world is going and how it's supposed to go and how it's ultimately going to end. And that story is one that is revealed in Scripture. And if you look at that story from that big sort of overarching perspective, what you'll see there is you'll see that there are sort of four movements or four major acts. There is what's sometimes referred to as creation, when God creates the world and makes things from the very beginning. And then there is, when after humans come on the scene, there's what is referred to as a fall, when human beings fall away from the original purposes that God put into creation. But then God didn't leave human beings to themselves and to their own destruction. Instead, what God does is he offers redemption through ultimately a long narrative that involves the children of Israel, consummated in the person of Jesus Christ and his work on the cross and his resurrection. But then that's not the end of the story, because here we are sort of in the midst, in between these last two movements, where redemption is taking place, but what we're headed toward is we're headed toward sort of a final restoration or a final consummation when everything will be as God ultimately and finally intends it. Now that is the Christian meta-narrative. That is the big story from the Christian perspective. And what I want to suggest is that if we're going to think Christianly about all these bioethical issues, we need to sort of put on the hat of that story. And that's what I want to do for you tonight in the next few slides. I want to put on that hat, that story, and just give you just a quick taste of why I think that these prevailing worldviews are deficient when looked at from the standpoint of the Christian story. So we're going to do that by looking at each movement. Movement number one is the movement that we call creation. So I think the first weakness of both of these cultural worldviews is that they really fail to take seriously the idea of creation and its implications for our understanding of these different biotechnological issues and bioethical issues. Because the creation story implies at least these three things, and perhaps a whole lot more, but again, this is just really big framing sorts of ideas. First, it implies that there really is a God. This comes out of the very opening line of the creation narrative in the book of Genesis in chapter 1. In the beginning, God. God creates. God is the one who is there from before the beginning. And since God is there, that has an implication for life. And the implication that it has for life is this. Life is ultimately about God's purposes for it. Right? God has purposes for creating life. Since he was there before life was there, and since he's the one who is the maker of life, there is an inherent purpose that's his that's there. And so it's not ultimately about our desires or about our intentions. And one of the things that these two worldviews get wrong is they get the idea wrong that's really an ancient error. It's an error that goes all the way back at least to the sophists in Greek philosophy, one of the most famous of which was Protagoras, who said, actually, was it Protagoras or Gorgias? I forget. You may have to help me out. Who said, man is the measure of all things. I think it was Protagoras. Pretty sure. Anyhow, both of these worldviews assume that it's us as human beings who determine what life's purpose is for ourselves. In fact, this is now embedded into our own constitutional theory. There was a Supreme Court case that was related to the ongoing battle over abortion cases. Forget off the top of my head which one it was, a few years ago, in which the majority opinion actually wrote in that part of the right of privacy includes the right to determine the meaning of existence for oneself. The meaning of existence for oneself, right? We now think, part of our culture, is that we think that's embedded into our culture and our thinking, that it is my right as a human being to determine the very meaning of existence. But the Christian perspective actually has a critique for this. It says, no, that's actually not our right. That's God's. It's God's who determines the meaning of existence because he was there from before the beginning. Moreover, the reality of God's purposes for creation entails an inherent normativity or a moral order that human beings are subject to from the start. Right? It's not as though we are in a world that we can do anything we want with. Rather, we're in a world as creatures. And because we're creatures, at least according to a Christian perspective, we're subjects. We're subjects. We're subjects to something higher that we have to answer to. And this is in contrast to the prevailing worldviews, both of which really, I think, believe that we can more or less do whatever we want. But the creation narrative in the Christian overarching story says, no, we can't actually do anything we want. There are some limits to the things that we can or ought to do, the things that we ought to do. Second, there's a Christian critique that comes from the second part of this overarching story, from the fall. And both of these cultural worldviews that I've already described, I think, fail to get something right from this. Because the reality of the fall implies that human desires and intentions are corrupt. even at our very best, even at our very best as human beings, we can't fully trust ourselves, even when we're at our very best, because we've got this corruption. There's something wrong with us. We are, as one author puts it, crooked timber, right? We're crooked timber. We're bent. There's something that's a little bit off in the way we are. And yet, both of the worldviews assume that we will ultimately know, as human beings, either from a democratic perspective, from the bottom up, or perhaps from a more aristocratic perspective, from the top down. Both worldviews assume that we will know, as human beings, what's in our own best interest. We can trust ourselves. They assume a kind of purity about our desire, or a purity about our intentions, and it assumes that we're capable of acting in keeping with the purity of our desires and our intentions. And I really think this is misguided. Even at our best, and I think history shows this, and those of you who are students of history probably know this, that even at our best, we have the capacity to be misguided in our judgments. And so we need a corrective from outside of ourselves. Then, thirdly, these worldviews, these cultural worldviews, really miss some important truths that come out of a Christian worldview, and especially out of redemption. Because redemption has both its own internal character or nature, and it also has a means, a way that's achieved. So the nature of redemption. Redemption is fundamentally, that is to say, at its root, at its core, it's fundamentally spiritual. It's about getting human beings right with their maker. There's something spiritually awry between a transcendent creator and an imminent creature, creation. And yet, what these prevailing cultural worldviews do is they tend to think of redemption. Of course, they don't think about redemption. That's why I put it in quotation marks. They tend to think of redemption as something that is fundamentally, and I would add, exclusively physical, right? What they're trying to do is they're trying to redeem us, redeem humans, to the effect that we're defective. But they think that our problem is fundamentally a physical problem. If we can just fix our genes, if we can just fix cure a disease, if we can just conquer death, if we can just fix any number of physical problems, then we'll be redeemed. That's what's behind these prevailing cultural worldviews. And the mistake there, I think, is this. The mistake is to think that that's what redemption is fundamentally about. It's actually something that's fundamentally spiritual. Now, please note, I have to note for those of you who may be thinking about this, I am not asserting, in saying what I'm saying now, that our physical bodies are of no consequence. Please don't hear me saying that. I am not. Nor am I saying that the creation is of no consequence. It's deeply significant, and our bodies are deeply significant, even in the process of redemption and ultimately moving toward consummation. What I'm saying is that the order has to be right. The physical redemption that ultimately we're all headed for in consummation comes out of first being reconciled spiritually to your Creator through Jesus Christ. And what these prevailing cultural worldviews have got backwards or missed altogether is the idea that there's any spiritual problem at all. Okay? So, the redemption, the means by which this is accomplished, is it's ultimately accomplished by God in Christ and not by us. Yet, these prevailing cultural worldviews think that redemption is something that human beings can do for themselves on their own. This is really the old Tower of Babel story, just repeated over again. Finally, as we think about consummation, this fourth aspect of God's big story, something that these two worldviews, I think, have significantly missed is both consummation's nature and also its means, because consummation is fundamentally about this. It is about the restoration of all of creation, including its physicality, with the Creator. That's what it's about. It's not about what many of the transhumanists, I think, want it to be about, which is about conforming reality to what we want it to be. So in that noble vision that many of the most altruistic scientists have, the noble vision is really ultimately about making the world and making the cosmos conform to our idea of what it should be like. And I think from a Christian perspective, that's not what consummation is about. Consummation or restoration is about the conformity of the world to the way God wants it to be, not the way we want it to be. And ultimately, it's not, it's going to be achieved by God and not by us or by our collective capabilities. Now, here's the so what. Okay? Why does any of this matter? What's really at stake in all of this? And why is this important, all the stuff that I've been talking about? Well, as I've already said tonight, the choices that you and I make as individuals as we deal with these issues, some of which may seem remote, but many of which, if you haven't already experienced them and dealt with them before, are really close. They're real-world issues. The choices you're going to make when you're sitting in the doctor's office or when you're going to the pharmacy or when you're dealing with infertility or when you're dealing with anything that we've talked about tonight, those choices will inevitably, this is just inescapable, they're going to be shaped by your worldview. That is to say, they're going to be shaped by your outlook on what you think life is all about and whether you think there's any limits on achieving what life is all about. And in a vacuum, that is to say, in the absence of deliberate Christian thinking about these issues, the prevailing two worldviews that I described earlier, those two will determine the course of the future. And let me just tell you, it's my judgment, my unprofessional opinion, that it's already happening now. Most of what has happened already in the past 30 to 40 to 50 years, where really bioethics became sort of its own animal, that has already been shaped and is being shaped by hedonistic consumerism and technological altruistic, what's my last word? Technological altruistic humanistic altruism. There we go. Yeah, humanism. I could have switched the words. There you go. That's the words. Those two worldviews are already shaping the future as we deal with these sorts of issues. That's already happening. And one thing that's fascinating to watch is when those two things actually come into conflict. They do. Those two worldviews sometimes compete with each other for the outcome. And it's really interesting to watch that. But in a vacuum of deliberate Christian thinking about these issues, that's what's going to happen. Now, the problem with that is that the prospect of having those prevailing worldviews determine the future of these issues in these three major categories, making life, taking life, and remaking life, is one that calls for serious engagement from a Christian perspective. And the reason for this is, at least so I think, as a Christian, I'm happy to answer questions about this during Q&A, is because ultimately it is only a Christian view of things, a Christian view of the world and of reality that offers a proper understanding of what it means to be human, of what happiness is, and of what it means to be healthy as well.